lunatics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I'm joined by the Midwestern defender of freedom himself, Jay Carson. Welcome to the show, Jay.
Good morning, Trey. Good to be here.
Yeah, I mean, I think today we could really call this show Republican and Rhino, or I don't...
No, Mike is taking a much well-earned vacation day here. So, yeah, while Mike's away, who knows what kind of trouble we can get into. But
well, we teased on Slack, one of the levels of support for or one of the things for supporters is that we were going to like take inflation seriously and all kind of crazy, you know, all kind of Republican crazy. But I think what we might actually start off on the show, we're going to kind of run through what we're going to be hitting up. So we're going to start by talking about the Supreme Court's, sort of ruling on the Texas abortion ban. We're going to talk about Biden's comments on Taiwan, China's response. We're going to talk about Manchin threatening zero spending and being comfortable with that. We're also going to move on and talk about the House voting for criminal contempt charges against Steve Bannon. Then we're going to move to Biden's commission on the Supreme Court and potentially a rough day for those on the left. And then finally, we're going to turn to a couple of items, including, if we have time, whether or not qualified immunity might be expanded in a recent Supreme Court case. We're going to talk about the future of the filibuster. And then we're going to maybe, probably later in the bonus show, we're going to take a look and talk about what's the face of the Republican Party in 2022 and 2024. Anything that we don't get here on the main show, of course, we will be getting to in our bonus show, which is just one of the many advantages you have for being a supporter of the show. So, Jay, before we jump into our first story, which is going to be the ongoing Supreme Court case on the Texas abortion ban, let's take a brief break for our sponsors. Okay, Jay. Well, this Friday, the United States Supreme Court issued an opinion allowing Texas' six-week abortion ban to remain in effect while it works its way through the courts. Now, Justice Sotomayor did, in fact, have a pretty harsh partial dissent, arguing that the court, by not allowing the temporary stay to remain in effect, is allowing a patently unconstitutional law to remain in effect because of a dubious enforcement mechanism. Jay, what do you think? I know, you know, this is one of the things that I have tried to follow a little bit more closely. I saw a lot of legal scholars think that the court was going to uphold the stay, and then it strikes that down. It does get an expedited process. What do you think the effect of this is going to be? And what's your take? I mean, I you know, that's your area. What do you think? Was the court right to remove the stay?
Yes and yes. When Mike and I talked about this a week or so ago, and probably the weeks before that, the big thing that I think people ought to look at is we're talking about a procedural issue here. And the court was pretty specific in the question that it granted this immediate certiorari for, which is again, it's an unusual procedure that it's doing this.
It's an expedited, and what it means is that, in other words, you don't have to go through all of the normal processes. They're going to let you. A writ of certiorari is the ability to be heard by the Supreme Court. They're going to accept your petition, your plea.
Right, and usually that process plays out over months or years. Right. I mean, the way it works is you go and you get a decision from a district court, and then you go to the Court of Appeals, and that process is about a year or so when you're getting a decision on the merits. And then, they go to the Supreme Court, and you've got quite a while in terms of filing briefs asking the court to accept it. And then the court can sit on that for, in some cases, years. Or move them on the list, off the list. And in this case, it's because we're talking about, questions of immediate relief, it's moving faster. But this is moving even faster for that, because it's still looking at that fundamental issue of not is this constitutional or not constitutional. And I think Mike and
right,
I
because the actual
yeah, it
the actual
it
item is here is whether or not the federal government can be a party to a suit in the case of this state enforcement mechanism.
Right. Do we have the right plaintiff and do we have the right defendants? And I think that's an important question. Some could say, well, they're dodging the issue. But look, this is the way courts operate, and there's a reason for it. I mean, otherwise, what you have is just sort of a, you know, 9-member super legislature that just, you know, well, hey, once a bill is passed, we'll just weigh in and give our opinion. And that's plainly, you know, that's not what the court was set up to do, to give advisory opinions. There has to be an actual conflict between actual parties, and it has to be an actual situation where the court can grant relief to one of those parties. And I think there's a real question here as to whether they've got the right parties. Now, in this one, there are abortion providers who are also plaintiffs along with the federal government. And my sense is they would have standing, as we discussed. But there's that question of, you know, typically for someone to have standing to challenge a law pre-enforcement, it's got to be a criminal penalty.
Right. But of course, in this particular instance, you're never going to have the criminal penalty. That's what makes the enforcement mechanism so unique.
Yeah. Well, what you would need is at some point someone to actually sue one of these providers for the $10,000. And then I would think have a court prepared to act on that. Right. I think that might be, you know, you have standing then, or, you know, once you were assessed the $10,000 fine, then you I don't know. It's a good question. Is it a fine? I suppose it is. That's
well. I mean,
that's
it's not actually
legal thing. Yeah.
Legally, in terms of an SB, the bill itself, it's not a fine. That would have then been a more straightforward
criminal type action.
It's a civil action.
Yeah. Although again, I think you can get into a debate over, you know, a rose by any other name, right? You know, if you're saying, look, there is a civil action that allows a non-affected party to seek damages to enforce something, you know, you're essentially creating private AGs, right? Which there are other statutes out there that do that, you know, different kinds of consumer statutes, fraud statutes, that sort of thing, where you allow a consumer to essentially bring a case like the attorney general would. So it's sort of like that. So I think there would be an interesting debate of whether this is a fine or whether it's civil damages. But regardless, in either case, none of that is, you know, neither one has been imposed at this point. And I think that's an issue.
So in my right ear, I'm hearing you talking, but in my left ear, I can hear the disembodied voice of Ken saying, look, you know, standing is just a court-created rule of access. It's just a barrier. The court gets to have it or not have it. And this is telling us something about the court, that they're not going to allow this to move forward and they're going to remove the stay. What do you respond to that kind of response to say, well, look, they're just hiding behind standing in this particular case because they want to allow this to remain in effect?
I mean, I want to take a shot at Ken because he's not here, but I don't think that from your here Ken's argument.
Five weeks ago, we had talked about how the rules of access for the court, standing being one of those, are really just kind of more or less manipulable things, and lawyers are going to make
prudential
the best
rules is probably maybe the best way to put it, right?
Say that one more time. I was over talking you. I'm sorry, Jay.
Prudential rules, meaning that, you know, the court will sort of decide in its own wisdom who has standing and who doesn't. And I would say, well, look, while that determination can vary, the principle remains the same. And I don't think, look, if the idea was that the court was just trying to dodge this and allow an unconstitutional law to stay in effect because they're saying the parties don't have the right standing, then I don't think you would see the court taking on the Mississippi case, right? Which does have the, you know, it is going to be a decision on the merits, on Roe v. Wade, or you know, Casey versus Planned Parenthood, that they're actually going to take that case up. So I don't see this as a dodge or an evasion, but I do think it's important from a again sort of judicial restraint type position that courts you know look at whether the parties have standing, and they don't just sort of jump into issues and start granting relief that are really political type policy questions, right? Unless it's teed up as here's someone who's got a constitutional right and they're being deprived of it. That's the problem, right? So I think, and if you think about this again over the long term, there's a conservative majority on the court right now. That's not always going to be the case. It hasn't always been the case. In fact, usually wasn't the case. So I think we ought to be cautious. Courts ought to be cautious about just wading into issues unless and until they know that they're on all fours there. And for a couple of reasons, one, that does speak to the court's legitimacy. Right now, there are issues where there are people out there who view the court's motives, decisions as all political. Mm-hmm. And to say politics plays no part, or I think political is probably the wrong word. I think it's ideological, maybe that is what people mean. To say that plays no part, I think would be sort of naive. But at the same time, they're not a super legislature. And I think that's, you know, the court needs to, for its own sake, keep those boundaries in place. And the more it shows that, listen, we are not acting as a super legislature, we're acting as a court, as that has traditionally been defined through, you know, common law going back 1,000 years. I think that's to their credit.
I've always wondered, you know, we have this term of the court ought not to be, and I like the way you're putting it there, the super legislature. But in the American jurisprudence tradition, which really in many ways begins with Marshall and Marbury, I mean, in many ways, isn't the court set up to effectively be the super legislature on rights as it's come to us through American precedent?
Well, yeah, I would say even before that, right? In the there was a, you know, judicial review was essentially imported to some extent.
But not in the version that we have. I mean, like, so in the United Kingdom, for example, because you don't have a written constitution, which is you know, for listeners, you know, in Marbury versus Madison, Marshall's big argument for why the court has this power that's not outlined in the Constitution, right? So there's nothing in Article 3 in the Constitution that gives the court really any kind of judicial power. And Marshall, he points to the fact that we have something unique from our predecessors, right? That, you know, that earlier precedent you're talking about, Jay. Right. He says, look, we have a written constitution, and because we have a written constitution, therefore the court has this ability to interpret what it means, and that's inherently a judicial power, and that's the, you know, the taking of that. So I mean, it's true that, you know, earlier courts had versions of that, but even today, UK courts can't strike down laws the way, I mean, that the Supreme Court in the United States can.
It's a different. And to say that they have a judicial review in the same way that we do would be imprecise. But that principle Marshall articulates in Marbury versus Madison, that is exclusively the province of the judiciary to say what the law is. Mm-hmm. Was something that had been established. And I would also point out in Federalist 37, I think it's Federalist 37. I will check and make sure I've got my number right. Hamilton makes essentially the argument for judicial review there, saying that, look, if one of these other parties oversteps their bounds, the court can say something. But at the same time, he also says, but don't worry, they're not going to be a super legislature because they're a court, and they're necessarily bound by those those rules of engagement, if you will, that, you know, we need, it is, I think in Hamilton's words, it was, you know, the court provides judgment, but, you know, nothing more, and envisioned it as sort of the weaker of the three branches. Now I'm off track. I'm wandering around.
Well, we're talking about the court, and we're thinking about it in terms of Texas and you know, taking up the law. And yeah, I think part of what you were getting at there was that the court has to balance its role of having judicial review with its legitimacy, which means that it can't allow itself to get tied up in too overtly of ideological matters. Am I summing that up?
It's one of those powers that if you use it too often, that's when legitimacy starts to erode, right? It's sort of like you've only got so many opportunities. And I mean, again, this is kind of weird theoretical, and there's no case I can point to on this, but if people have the sense that, listen, the Supreme Court is there as a backstop and it weighs in on these serious issues when it needs to, when there are specific rights to be determined between parties, and it doesn't just wade in because, hey, there's something Congress did that we don't like, there is that more respect, more legitimacy. However, the more often the court, you know, becomes involved. Again, there's sort of the more you do, the more you risk that you lose that sense of impartiality, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that makes sense on a common sense kind of level.
Well, you know, I think we're kind of getting into this broader question of the court, its legitimacy, and what it should do. And if you'd be willing, Jay, what I'd like to do is maybe pause for a sponsor break for just a minute, and then come back, and maybe we should talk about the early draft of the Biden Commission's Supreme Court reforms, because I think we're kind of starting to, you know, wade into those waters, if that's amenable to you.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, let's pause for a brief break from our sponsors, and then when we come back, Jay and I are going to take up the Biden Commission's draft report. Okay, so Jay, you know, in our last segment, we were focusing on the Supreme Court's decision in terms of Texas and the abortion bill. But, you know, we were talking about that, we were getting into thinking about the Supreme Court, its legitimacy, and I think a lot of this is tied up. And this week, we had some of that, as a matter of fact, come to a kind of a head. This past week, Biden's Supreme Court Commission issued some draft findings, and I don't think it lived up to the expectations of many on the left. It had a historical overview. I don't know how much of it but you got a chance to read. It's a really great historical overview. I mean, it kind of oozes academic-iness.
Yeah.
But what it
which is the point.
Yes,
sort of,
exactly.
Right? I mean, from the political standpoint, that's the point. Yeah,
that was indeed the point. But from the ideological standpoint, where it began to maybe disappoint some, was that it did not, in fact, kind of come out in favor of changing the size of the court. So although it sees the size change or these other kinds of changes to the Supreme Court as potentially being legal, of course, they have all kinds of potential secondary negative effects. The draft itself states that the pursuit of court expansion, for example, is nothing more or less than a partisan context. And further, quote, there are other reasons to believe expansion of efforts might have negative effects on the Supreme Court's long-term legitimacy or otherwise undermine its role in our legal system, end quote. Specifically, the Supreme Court could keep growing so that every time each side won and had unified government, it would expand. And the reason
I'll
I wanted
get there
to,
eventually. Yeah.
Yeah, it would just, you know, maybe have 28 people is one of the examples from the...
Sooner or later, they got to pick my name.
So what I'm wondering is one, I mean, I think we were getting at this, right? The fact that we're having this kind of conversation, that Biden puts this out, I think in part is because there are many who either see, and I think it's conflicting, and so you can maybe agree or disagree with me on this. I think there's one camp that sees that the court has become too expansive in its power. And I think we were kind of hinting at that and getting into that in the last segment. But then I think there's another group, primarily from the left, who's okay with the expansiveness of the court, but they're not okay with the ideological makeup of the court. So they want the court to be controlled by, you know, a different ideological makeup.
Right. They're okay with expansiveness as long as it's their guys running
yes,
it.
Yes, exactly.
In that case, let's be as expansive as we can.
So you have those kind of two teams in an uneasy alliance. And I don't think for either of them they were expecting, although maybe they should, I think they should have. I don't think they were expecting that they would get such kind of a tame, you know, this tame commission report. You know, as a matter of fact, that stalwart of the left, The Nation, sees the commission as just a way for Biden to duck changing the court in a meaningful way. So Jay, what do you think about all of this?
Again, it's a weird day when I'm agreeing with The Nation, but The Nation, the magazine, not The Nation, the people.
Yeah,
but,
an important distinction.
No, they're absolutely right. And this is something, you know, when this commission was proposed, Mike and I had talked about this, and we drew the exact same conclusion. And the conclusion that the report we got is more or less exactly the report that I expected. And you know, what was going on was Biden was running for president. He's getting these tough questions because he's getting calls from the left saying, we want you to pack the court. He is trying to run as a moderate. And he knows that if he goes on the record saying, you know, oh, yes, I'm going to pack the Supreme Court, that's going to hurt him in a lot of places, especially among moderate Democrats. And it's going to very much drive conservatives to the polls. Who would, I think, quite rightfully see it as a power grab. Biden, I mean, I think one thing you can say is got that sort of institutional historical knowledge, partially by experience. And look, the biggest shellacking that FDR took was over this mm-hmm. precise issue. Now you can say, well, look, that was, 70, 80 years ago. But the point is, those things are still sort of strong, and there's still sort of a conservative sense, and I mean this in a small c way, of people are reluctant to have big structural changes in their government. And again, rightfully so. I think that's a good instinct. And when you're talking about, well, let's add four more members, well, just because I don't like some of the members who are on there now, I think that's a perfectly reasonable position. So Biden was stuck in a, what do I do to appease my voters on the left and not scare center moderates away or drive conservatives to the polls? So he did this, you know, well, I'll think about it. I'll get some really smart people to think about it and issue a report, and it's going to give him political cover. And that's exactly sort of what happened. So let me ask you a question
about that, because you came up to it, and I think you put it eloquently there when you were talking about that small c conservative nature of the court. One of the reasons I think this has the political legs, the reason it's made it as far, like why even have a commission, seems to me that we're kind of in this state in Congress where that lowercase c conservatism has on both sides is really just kind of gone.
Yeah.
So one of the things in the document itself, it outlines like, well, what's even the reasons for the calls for this? And on this, I deeply agree with the draft finding, which is, right, so Republicans, you know, create this rule for we can't put Obama's pick through, and then we flip-flop on that, you know, unstated rule so that we can put Trump's person through at the last minute. And again, there's nothing technically wrong with that, right? I mean, Senate can do what the Senate wants to do. I mean, you have the majority, you can do it. But of course, by doing it in that way, you break your own precedent and you break that own kind of lower C conservatism. And I think for those on the left, their response is to say, well, look, fine, you do that. But that means then when we can have majorities, Constitution, and this gives us the power to do things like expand the court. So, you know, what's your argument now? So when I hear that, like, well, you know, we need to have that lower C, I think for many, they're going to see that as being a little bit kind of, well, it's all well and good to be conservative when it's us having to, you know, suffer the, the slow consequences. What do you say to that?
I think you're right. I mean, we're sort of in the position we're in a little bit now because, well, for a couple reasons, and bigger picture, is something that, you know, comes up on the show a whole lot, is just the reluctance of Congress to really legislate that much anymore, right? It's just everything is sort of punted to agencies or made so ambiguous. And it's just the idea of, look, we're going to pass something and we'll let the courts figure it out later. Thereby putting the court in that position of super legislature, whether the court asks for it or not. Mm-hmm. And that applies to the federal government and state governments. You know, that's sort of exactly what Texas did here, right?
Unique, weird mechanism, and then make somebody else tell them that they can't.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Let's come up with the goofiest sort of thing we can do. Now, and I would distinguish that between, I think there are statutes where you can do a, hey, where the law is unclear or the lines are unclear, let's pass a statute and get some clarity, right? Let's see how far we can go. I think that's a little different than what Texas did here. But that's part of it, right? I mean, legislators are sort of punting to the court more often than not. And look, maybe it's not their fault because there's groups out there who are going to bring these suits anyway, or parties who are going to bring these suits anyway. So there's that. The distinction I would make between the small c change to, the court composition versus the process, is that the process is, I think, easier to fix or could be fixed. And what I'm talking about,
give us an example. Explain that a little bit more.
So for example, I mean, I guess, and I'm not pointing fingers here, Harry Reid, but this goes back to sort of the so-called nuclear option as court appointments became sort of more high stakes because more decisions were being made, more law was being made in the courts. You had this tendency of, we got to make sure we have the right people there, Harry Reid brought in the so-called nuclear option and it got rid of the filibuster for
nominations that weren't the Supreme Court.
And that sort of left it, that took out the old way of saying, look, we need to have pretty strong bipartisan buy-in on any nominee.
But of course, it's Senate Republicans in 2017 who remove it for the Supreme Court, right? Harry Reid removes it for other appointments that were being consistently blocked and not allowed to move forward.
Yeah. And that's exactly right. I mean, so this is all playing out in the legislative process. But I think there's a difference there between, if you're changing these sort of rules, and again, my preference, the small c conservative position, would have been not to have changed these to start. Mm-hmm. But it's easier to undo. And the other piece of it is, no one particularly worries, I guess, about Congress's or the Senate's legitimacy, if you know what I mean. I mean, it's accepted as, this is a political institution and they're going to do political things and make political choices. Whereas a court is ideally above partisan politics. And that's where there's a distinction, I think.
I've never asked you this question point blank. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were pausing there. Finish that thought, Jay.
No, I was just sort of stumbling. Everyone would seem to accept a partisan Congress, a partisan Senate, because look, you've got a remedy, right? Just vote the bums out. It's quite different to say there's a partisan court that serves for a lifetime.
So let me ask about that, because, on the academic side and the legal scholarship, the answer is that the court is, in fact, primarily ideologically driven, that you can explain most of the variation in court opinions most of the time by the predilections of the Supreme Court members, and that everything the court therefore is doing is kind of more or less a maybe facade is a strong word, but it is the trappings of things to try to make it seem less that way, right? So, for example, you know, the court still gets up high on a bench and wears their medieval garb, right? You know, what other institution continues to wear their medieval garb besides the court, right? You know, even academics, those of us who are, you know, kind of very much attached to this, you know, we only put it on when forced to by administrators, right, at graduation, right? And the point here being not just, you know, that it's this kind of symbolic idea that we're going to mask what's actually kind of happening. And so, you know, that there's some data to say that. So I think some would say, well, isn't the court, I mean, really, isn't it truly kind of ideological? And the rest of this is just the court's attempt to avoid that appearance, even though that is in fact what happens?
Well, I don't think you're wrong there, right? But ideology is something that's different than politics. They're related, they're close, but mm-hmm. but it's one thing to say the court has an ideological bent, or justices of the court have an ideological bent as to how the Constitution or statutes ought to be interpreted. It's something else to say that the court or members of the court have a political bent on this is a particular policy I want to see enacted, and I think you can look to people like Justice Scalia. You can say, listen, he certainly had his preferred outcomes, but he also, I mean, one of his famous statements, it was, you know, he said he wished he had a stamp that said stupid but constitutional.
yeah,
you know, and that's sort of the sense. And so, I mean, determining something, whether something is constitutional, you know, is this within the power of the executive branch to do X, Y, or Z, is necessarily a separate question than is X, Y, or Z a good policy. The problem is that issue can get muddled, you know, especially in the popular press and the you know, popular media. So I would agree with you that you know, things are it's ideological, and I think you could say certainly there were decisions in the past that have been sort of boarded into political, like small p political, if that makes sense. I mean, not necessarily.
I think I know what you mean, Jay, yeah, but I'm not positive. I mean,
maybe political in terms of the court defending itself or asserting itself against the other two branches, as opposed to political in a partisan manner. So, for example, Marbury versus
Madison. A balance of power. Yeah. Political, not yeah. an outcome political.
Yeah. So, for example, Marbury versus Madison, that's, you know, sort of your big example of the court is, I mean, on, they're acting politically on one, you know, in one sense. And look, there was a political undertone underneath that, right, between the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans on who gets, you know, how this is going to turn out. And
well, as a matter of fact, if you think about it, I hadn't thought about this particular, but, you know, in part that is an era where the court is not the same, in this case, political outcome as the rest of government, right? So, you know, you have Democratic Republicans, i.e. the Jeffersonians, take control of office. And so the only place that Federalists are left, of course, is in the courts, because that's who Adams and his Senate was able to appoint, you know, even in Marbury, right? So yeah. Marshall is writing the opinion, but of course, he's the principal reason why there's a case in the first place, right? He's ruling on his own issue.
It's one of those things that's impossible to say. Let's take the poll. Let's assume that this doesn't occur in a political backdrop. Let's forget that. Yeah, Marshall probably does not want to see Marbury get appointed. But he's also conscious of the bigger picture of one, establishing and defending the court's integrity in what's, you know, really one of its first big tests, and two, asserting the court's power against the other two branches.
Yeah, that's what I mean
when I say political, as opposed to just, well, hey, we like the Affordable Care Act, therefore it's constitutional.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, again, in the case of Marshall, you know, Marshall probably would have wanted Marbury to have his commission, but he doesn't think that Jefferson's going to give it up. And so he's in this kind of tough spot, right? I mean, he was the one who had failed to deliver the commissions in the first instance.
Right. Yeah. Like I said, he's trying to navigate, how do I maintain the integrity of the court in this situation? And he comes up with these sort of, Marbury should probably get his commission, but
I can't give it to him.
Nothing I can do about it.
Yeah. By the way, we're striking down this part of the law. I got this car. Yeah. And in that sense, it's one of the most unusual court cases where you get all of this legal reasoning for why he should get the commission, but then you don't get the commission because I have this power. Well, yeah. I think what we should probably do for a minute, Jay, then is I think maybe we should pause there, take a break from our sponsors, and then when we come back, take a look a little bit, get away from the courts for a minute, and talk a little bit about foreign policy, which is not something we've gotten to talk about a lot, specifically taking a look at Biden's recent comments at the town hall regarding China and Taiwan, and then China's response this week. So we'll take a brief break, and we'll be right back. So Jay, earlier this month, on October 8th, as a matter of fact, Ken and I discussed Chinese aggressions towards Taiwan and started just an early speculation about thinking about this. This has gotten a lot more, you know, that was a lower priority story. This week, though, at the CNN town hall, Biden, echoing earlier comments he's already made, stated the United States would come to Taiwan's defense if it was attacked. Asked if the U.S. would do this, he said, quote, yes, we have a commitment to do that, end quote. On Friday, in an apparent response to President Biden, the Chinese government issued a statement arguing that there was, quote, no room, end quote, for compromise over Taiwan. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Werbin said, quote, when it comes to issues related to China's sovereignty and territorial integrity and other core interests, there is no room for China to compromise or make concessions. And no one should underestimate the strong determination, firm will, and strong ability of the Chinese people to defend national sovereignty and territorial integrity, end quote. He would go on to state that Taiwan is an inalienable part of China's territory, i.e. this is totally a national sovereignty and a territorial integrity issue. Now, on this show, I mean, you know, in addition to just this guff up between Taiwan and China, you know, we have talked extensively about the ongoing relationship between China and the United States. We started talking about it in terms of trade and that kind of deterioration during the Trump era, but that's clearly not going to be just a Trump presidency feature. It continues to be a continuing feature during the Biden presidency. Now, Jay, Ken argued that the United States would ultimately have to back down from China in the case of Taiwan. We're not going to have some go. But these comments from Biden seem to suggest he's at least willing to engage in a war of words for the time being. What do you think about this? We haven't had a chance to talk about this one, Jay.
Yeah, first I'd say, General Milley, there's a call on line one for you. on the one hand, I very much appreciate what Biden said in terms of saying that we have this strong commitment. Do we have a treaty commitment? No, we don't. We made this specifically and intentionally. This, you know, the words they're used is strategic ambiguity in the Taiwan Relations Act of 1979. And in that act, it essentially said, listen, we'll provide defense and help and assistance to the people of Taiwan. It did not, you know, but it's not a NATO type treaty commitment of attack on Taiwan as an attack on the United States. And I think there's a couple things that are going on. One is is Biden just talking off script? I think that's a big concern when he's just out there doing this stuff, because it seems most of his administration walked this back pretty quickly the following day.
This would be the second time he's done it, which makes you wonder if there's not a bit of a tension between what his position may be and what his advisors might like it to be.
What his administration's position is? Well, yeah, that's which is a little troubling, which is why I made the joke about the phone call to General Milley. I think that's what our policy ought to be. Is it what our policy is right now? Not really. And there are a couple of reasons for that. On the one hand, I think you can say in 1979 and throughout this time, strategic ambiguity made sense, because the conflict seemed sort of remote. Right? Is it possible that the Chinese are going to invade Taiwan? Sure, it's possible. Is it likely? They make noises about it and would do some saber rattling.
But they weren't flying planes into their airspace.
Exactly. Yeah. Did we believe that they really had the capability to pull it off? Probably not. Did we have the other forces there to stop them if they did? Probably yes. And I think that calculation is different now. So I would be extremely concerned if I were in Taiwan. So maybe it is time to change that policy and make it more strategic and less ambiguous, right? Less that ambiguity invite more Chinese military action. So we'll see. I mean, the flip side of this is if Biden says things like, yes, we'll come to Taiwan's aid, you get that line in the sand problem of, well, okay, what if someone calls his bluff? And that's a bigger concern. So, I'm all for robust defense of Taiwan. And I think we should make it clear that that is our policy. That said, I mean, I think Biden misspoke, saying, well, this is, we have an obligation or that sort of thing. So that's kind of my two cents on it.
Well, to add a little bit there, I would say that I think, and this is more in my wheelhouse, so, I will try not to get too focused, but in presidencies, in the modern presidency, in the post-Brownlow era. So for listeners, the Brownlow report is what comes during FDR's era, and FDR makes this plea to say that the president doesn't have enough help to get done all the things that Congress has delegated to the executive branch to do, and as a result, that there needs to be an expansion in the institutional presidency. And so many scholars will see there being this pre and post Brownlow era presidency. In the post Brownlow era, where you have this large administrative staff, a new president coming in is kind of like you're on the head of a steam liner, right? And it's been going in one direction, and maybe you think it should go in a different direction, but you're on a boat, so you can't instantaneously push all of it on a dime the way you might have wanted to. And maybe that's, as a matter of fact, potentially a flaw in the contemporary presidency, because the idea of the presidency was to have energy, according to the framers. But be that as it may, you have this kind of push. So I don't think it's necessarily unusual where you have a president who's trying to kind of push the institutional presidency in particular ways, especially when you're talking about military matters. So I think you're right. I agree with you, Jen, that front, that I think there could be some tensions there, but I don't think that's necessarily uncommon. I think that's part of being a president, and it's hard to think about, but it's still the first year of the Biden presidency.
But do you get the sense, though, that this was, and maybe you're giving Joe Biden more credit than I am, this was an intentional presidential statement to change policy or push policy in a certain way, or was he just saying whatever came to him on off the top of his head?
Maybe I'm giving him too much credit.
When you look at the video, right? When you look at a lot of his, it seems like the latter.
If it would have only been one,
you get the walk back the next day. Yeah. Saying, well, that wasn't really what he meant.
If it had only been one, then I would agree with you. But the fact that this is the second in his comments on this makes me wonder if this isn't him kind of using his Neustadtian position, his power of the presidency in terms of persuasion, to kind of push at his own institution to move it in certain ways, even though it gets walked back. So that would be my read. You know, if it had just been this one,
yeah, it's getting walked back by Jen Psaki, right? I mean, it's getting walked back by his press.
Yes, but that could still be this attempt to kind of push on your institution in certain ways to say, well, I am going to talk about these things, even if I'm going to, for now, maybe roll it back a little bit into that kind of the ambiguity of the 70, you would even mention 73, right?
79. There was a letter. I think there was the initial letter back when in 73, where we were ambiguous, saying, "Is there a one China policy?" And we sort of said, "Well, sure, but we're not saying which China it is."
right. And,
back when Kissinger, when the initial trips were made, but this was in 79, which was an actual act of Congress having to do with, what do we do with Taiwan? Because we don't officially recognize them as their own state still because of that 1973 letter.
Right.
If you remember, Donald Trump took criticism because he accepted a call from the Taiwanese. Yeah, I said it, Chinese.
Well, yeah, that's the crazy thing. Who is the Chinese? Right, yeah.
And John Cena, the I might say the rightful president of China, everyone was aghast that, oh my God, we can't do this, you can't take a phone call from this guy, so I think there's that. I'm skeptical of that Biden's playing three dimensional chess here, and this wasn't just something that he just kind of said, because Biden says a lot of stuff. He said he'd been to the border a lot too, but not really. You know what I mean?
I think one of the things that maybe it's harder for the Biden as a presidency is that we're coming from the era of the Trump presidency where it felt like literally everything was just off the wall, in a sense.
Yeah.
So I wonder sometimes...
Don't mind him, he's the president. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder if sometimes that kind of relevancy bias, right? We oftentimes want to make predictions based on our most recent experiences, and so it could be easy to be using that kind of Trump model. Now, but before we get too far on that, the other thing I kind of wanted to ask you here, and then before we do a last story, was to say, what do you think about the fact that as a Republican, one of the items, and I'm a libertarian who has worked long with Republicans, the idea that it is trade that allows for peace, it is trade that allows for these kinds of measures to go forward. So even as we were talking about this during the Trump presidency, I'd floated many times, as we continue to have trade battles with China, the likelihood that we're going to have other kinds of confrontations with China will go up. And I know that was not universally always what Ken and others agreed with. So I'm curious about you. Do you see this as being the natural extension of the fact that we've now had 4 years of ongoing kind of trade disputes with China? And as we continue to make those breakdowns, that we're going to continue to have these kinds of other means of conflict? Or do you, like others, think that I'm crazy on that front?
I think you're crazy. this is a conflict that's been going on since 1950, and mainland China, the Chinese Communist Party, has always claimed that Taiwan is a renegade province and that it's going to get it back one day. So I think it's more, it has less to do with trade. Let me back up. The Chinese, I think, now believe they're in a stronger position than where they've ever been. and therefore can flex their muscles when it comes to this. Part of this might be the sense that they care less about the U.S. in terms of trade than they might have 4 years ago, 5 years ago, 20 years ago. And now they say, look, that this may be our time. We're essentially establishing hegemony in over the East, and there's nothing you can do to stop us about it. And look, this has been the long term plan from the beginning. You know, there's the story of the it's probably apocryphal of the you know, Chinese foreign minister. Oh gosh, who was the Chinese foreign minister in the 70s?
I don't know that one, Jay. I'm sorry.
Anyway, it'll come to me later. Meeting with Henry Kissinger, and they're making, you know, talk, and Kissinger says, you know, what do you believe is the impact of Napoleon's impact on world history? And the Chinese foreign minister says, too early to tell. again, I don't know that actually happened. It's one of those sort of political apocryphal stories that are told, right?
Yeah.
But that it sums up that this is the Chinese take the long view. And I think this is more that type of situation. It's not a reaction to, well, we've got some trade dust ups with the U.S. So now we're going to flex our muscles on Taiwan. I think that also, I mean, that sort of assumes sort of a, U.S. centric sort of view that Trump would probably go with, right? That look, it's all about us and whatever other countries do. Well, it must be because they're reacting or responding to something that the United States has done. But no, this is a Chinese thing and has been for you know, since, like I said, since 1950, really since 1937, the Chinese Civil War. Maybe before that. We do these shows in the morning and we always go directions that I don't think we're going to go.
Listen, I'd like to throw you for a loop, Jay, right? This is a little different, but you know, I appreciate you pushing back. I still think that kind of that realpolitik idea.
Can I jump in real quick?
Say what?
Zhou Enlai.
There you go.
Chinese foreign minister. Sorry about that. Again, it's early still. And yeah.
Listen, no, I mean, it's amazing. We do so many, you do all this prep for the show. You know, you have to kind of get ready for things, but you can't get ready for every single, it's like a pop quiz.
It's like Jeopardy. Yeah.
You know, who is the former?
Yeah.
But I, you know, trying to get back, I do think that this real politic view is a negative one. And one of the things I didn't like about Trump, and where he aligned, I think, with many on the left, especially like Sanders, is in this idea of the zero sum game of trade, and kind of ignoring some of the evidence that exists when it comes to what makes for more stable and less stable long term relationships. I don't see that being as an American centric view, but rather just a data and a social scientific centric view. But I'm not the one who gets to call those shots. So, man, we've been going long, Jay. So why don't we? I do want to at least get to this one last story, and then we'll just boot everything else into the bonus show. So we're gonna have this awesome bonus show. So for listeners, you know, as soon as this one's done, you're gonna want to get into that. But why don't we turn to Manchin threatening zero spending here as we come back from a break. Well, Jay, this week there's been a lot of news coming out of the Build Back Better bill. There's a phrase for you. Also known as the $3.5 trillion inflation increase. Wait, did I say that? Was that biased? I don't know. Anyway, there is a lot to unpack here, but Biden has signaled a willingness this week that he could go much lower to get the bill passed. Even some specifics like not having the child credit, go beyond a year, pulling back on, you know, free community college tuition. There's a number of different items this week that he signaled on that front. As a matter of fact, even as late Friday and early this morning on Saturday, that continues to come out. But I think the day that encapsulates a lot of what's happening in the Democratic side of things was Wednesday, Jay, when we had a showdown between Manchin and Sanders, in which, according to other senators present, so this is pretty reliable, Manchin told Sanders he is comfortable with nothing, zero, as a matter of fact, forming that with his fingers. He argues that this will contribute to inflation. In other words, we need to take a pause, kind of see what's going to happen. We've already passed some large spending bills, and that's something we've already talked about on the show. The other bit of news that came out about the same time this week was that Manchin was considering leaving the Democratic Party, or at least had a plan in place in case he needed to leave the Democratic Party. And according to sources, floated that idea among his fellow Democrats, potentially as a levering chip over the upcoming spending bill. And according to the report, his exit plan would have him calling himself an American independent, although there's really no idea of who he'd caucus with. I mean, his only other option is going to be the Republican Party, the same way that Sanders, an independent, caucuses with the Democratic Party. So no, I think a lot of times, Jay, we've spent a lot of time in these last 4 years. I know it's been a big deal for both of us because, you know, we've often been with the Republican Party. You know, in this post, we've been looking at the Trump splits. But I think in this post-Trump era, in the Biden era, we're now going to need to start talking about these similar rifts over different items, of course, in the Democratic Party. So is the Democratic Party the party of Sanders? Is it the party of Manchin? Or does Manchin bolt? And I think we're going to see that continue to come out in this bill. So what do you think about, you know, the Manchin being comfortable with zero, the continued efforts by progressives to hold out for a larger spending bill to go along with the infrastructure bill?
I'd say, man, would I wish we'd have Republicans who would go on record and say, I want zero spending. Right. I mean, that's sort of one of my laments, is sort of a you know, budget hawk type person. And that's a complaint that a lot of Republicans have, is, listen, we elect these people to control spending or even cut spending. And once they get in office, they're all too happy to go along, to get along. Is Manchin exaggerating? Maybe. Look, he's making the rhetorical point that I don't think we need this, period. So, I mean, to my mind, I mean, more power to him. I know so many people on the left think this is somehow horrible, or he's holding the government hostage. He's holding Biden's agenda hostage. But look, let's presume he's following his conscience. But two, let's presume he's a craven political actor. He's following his constituents. His constituents in West Virginia do not want this massive spending bill, and I think it's pretty reasonable for him to say so. Whether he switches parties, I mean, that, you know, that doesn't happen often.
No. I mean, when the last time be Jeff
Jim Jeffords.
Jim Jeffords, yeah.
And again, that's one of those that, I don't know. There's also sort of a, this is one of those just sayings in politics, is that sooner or later you join the team you're on.
yeah.
And so I don't know. I mean, maybe he does, but or maybe he gets the boot. I mean, he might realize that while he could, you know, taking this position, he could cruise to whatever position he wants in West Virginia, whether it's another term of senator or governor or something else. But he might have trouble in a Democratic primary.
Right.
Those are things I think that he probably is thinking about. But that said, I think it's, I'm not sure what else to say to Joe Manchin other than congratulations. and although, again, I sort of picked on him last week for, shouting how he's going to raise taxes on the rich from the deck of his yacht. But, Democrats are going to have to negotiate with him. Those are the numbers.
Well,
that's
here's my worry, and I'm curious to get your take on this. Is, you know, you were talking about, and this is something I've known about you, Jay, you're a deficit hawk, and you said that again just a moment ago. So one of the problems that I see with our spending patterns in the United States is that when Republicans are in office, what they will end up focusing on is tax cuts, which is fine in and of itself.
Which is good.
But it never comes along with any kind of corresponding cuts in spending, which leads to inflationary problems, to increased debt. And what I'm worried that I see happening here is that what we're going to end up with is what Democrats end up doing, which is oftentimes kind of the reverse of that, which is to say, well, we're going to pay for this through tax increases. But it looks increasingly likely that like one of the big elements of this bill that's going to have to get pared back, so much so that Biden's being asked, well, how are you going to pay for it, you know, given that your centrist senators are not any, don't seem to be uniformly on board with raising taxes, is, well, we'll have to figure it out somehow. Well, I think generally figuring it out somehow means that once again, we increase in this case spending, but we keep revenue neutral, which is the other side of the deficit.
Which means
deficit,
we borrow more.
Exactly. Yeah. And so no matter which party is in power, we get, you know, either increases in spending or decreases in taxes, but we don't ever get anything that resembles fiscal responsibility, because both sides then end up kicking it down the inflationary road.
Yeah, no, here. I mean, I can't agree with you more. You know, I look back to, and you're younger than I am, but you know, to me that in 96, when Republicans pushed for some modest decreases in spending relating to the rate of growth of Medicaid and Medicare, they were pilloried by the press as this is heartless, this is mean. There were ads showing Newt Gingrich, and I think maybe Paul Ryan, literally pushing grandma off the cliff.
That was Newt Gingrich. That was before that. Paul Ryan and I were still
in
college together.
But you know, that's the sort of and the media took it hook, line, and sinker that we're slashing benefits. What was happening was we were cutting the rate of growth from something like 5% to something like 4% or 3.5%. And it's sort of you can't even get away with saying we're going to limit the rate of growth without being accused of slashing and defunding programs and pushing grandma off the cliff.
Well, I mean, again, look among your most conservative Republicans, Jay, right? I continually have this kind of argument and debate with them, right? You can't touch things like Social Security. You know, they've earned that. They've got to have it. Well, of course, if you're not willing to touch, you're mentioning Medicaid, if you're not willing to talk about those, there's really only three major spending items that results in most of our federal budget, right? And for the most part, they, you know, individuals, conservative to liberal, are not willing to touch on those. And I think you're right. They did get pillared. And I think in part because even Republicans, even those kind of don't really want to have to look at what it would do. And that's an area where I thought that George W. Bush was right, you know, when he wanted to try to make some reforms to Social Security, because that really would have had an impact on budgetary items down the line if we could have had opportunities for to kind of have 401k kind of accounts for Social Security. Heck, even the Al Gore version where you can't spend the money that comes in from Social Security taxes so that you at least have some monies there that are accumulating on it would have been a better plan. I think George W. Bush had the best plan. But
it becomes more of a saving an investment plan as opposed to the Ponzi scheme that it is.
Right, because, I mean, just so the listeners know, right, you know, your Social Security taxes, I mean, it looks different when you're doing your taxes, but it goes into the same general budget, right?
Yeah.
They
pretend it's a separate budget, but really it isn't.
They
borrow against it to fund the current budget.
Right, which is effectively the same as me saying, "Well, I'm going to borrow out. I'm borrowing out of my checking account or my savings account so that my checking account can not dip into zero as quickly."
Yeah.
Well,
no, it's exactly right. And again, the idea that that you have paid into these programs or paid in these benefits, and therefore you have a defined benefit that you're going to get out. It doesn't work like that. You're actually paying for someone else's benefits right now, and someone else in the future will hopefully pay for yours. And I think that's a, you know, again, it's just a fundamental distinction, and Republicans haven't been great at making that case. And to some extent, it's the press that you got to get through that, you know, there no one wants to hear that. But yeah, one of my big arguments, and this is, you know, back from when I was in college, was concerned about entitlements, that they're going to keep growing and eat up more and more of our spending, our economy. And then you add in the interest that you're paying on those programs as the deficit grows, that sooner or later you're left with nothing else. And I mean, the joke before that our government is essentially it's an insurance company with nuclear weapons. you know, I mean, if you look at what, you know, where we spend our money, that's huge. And there's not going to be any meaningful reform. And you know, the other thing that Mike and I often get into is when I talk about let's cut this and this out of discretionary spending. And so often Republicans aren't willing to even go that far. And the argument is, well, what does it matter if we cut a little bit from, say, the IRS budget or from some other department, you know, foreign aid, whatever, because that's not the real problem. It's the entitlements. And all that's true. But if you don't have the discipline to even make those small cuts, how are you ever going to make the big choices? And so, but I'm sort of preaching to the choir on this.
well, and I think one of the other,
at least Joe Manchin's listening.
Yeah, right? I think on the Manchin front, another right. I think we forget that in our system, individual members of Congress have an immense amount of power in the Senate. In ordinary times, and this isn't an ordinary time because you have a very, very divided Senate, and this is what you would expect. Yeah, I think sometimes individuals kind of want to expect what you have in more of a parliamentary system, and we have the exact opposite of that. We don't have a parliamentary system, and therefore parties don't have the kind of sway that you might assume that they do, you know, just in that kind of popular conception. But Jay, we have gone long. So it's been a lot of fun doing this, but we're gonna have a bunch of things for the bonus show. So for listeners, I want to thank you for listening to the Politics Guys. I know that for Jay and myself, we love doing this, but we don't always get it all in. So we're going to have, we're going to be talking about a number of things, including kind of responding to a big listener question about kind of the evolution of the Republican Party. So I want to thank you guys again for listening to the show. If you can, go ahead and subscribe or rate us on the podcast app of your choice. Of course, you can always share those episodes as well. But one of the big ways is that we actually need your financial support. And that means that you're going to get other kinds of cool content and access. And that includes things like the show that's going to be coming to you immediately after the end of the show, which is the bonus show. We have a full-length supporters-only show. We also have a Discord channel where we get on and talk. I know that Mike and I enjoy doing that. Supporters can gain access to Discord, but there's all other kinds of levels of support and things that you can have. So if you want to become a supporter or check out more of the benefits of supporting the Politics Guys, you can check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/politicsguys, or you can just go to politicsguys.com/support. So you can join myself and Jay again by heading to patreon.com/politicsguys. I know right now we're also taking a look at a supporters level for transcripts of the show. So again, head to patreon.com/politicsguys if you're interested in making transcripts of the Politics Guys a reality. If you've got a question, comment, or correction, or just some random thought you'd like to share with us, you can reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Twitter at Politics Guys. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilma Marino, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Chris Wilkerson, and Ryan Beasley. Today's show was produced by myself, Trey Orndorff. I hope you'll join us next time.